I'm Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty, and we've decided to do a podcast called We Don't Have to Choose. Why that title? Well, several years ago, I heard Rachel Barco give a presentation at the University of Minnesota, and she said that if the criminal legal system was a private corporation, it would have been bankrupt years ago. And that got me to thinking, why? Why does the criminal legal system not work to keep us safe? And what will keep us safe? That's what we're going to talk about on the podcast, that we don't have to choose between public safety and reform or changes or advancement, that those things we are trying to do here at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office will bring us public safety. Welcome to the We Don't Have to Choose podcast, named because we do not have to choose between public safety and reform. Our first episode, we had Professor Rachel Barco, who is an expert, has written a number of books, done a lot of research about why the system doesn't keep us safe. Today, we're really fortunate to have Resma Menakem as our guest. Resma is a healer, a therapist, an author, and the founder of Somatic Abolitionism. The first book of yours I read was My Grandmother's Hands, and I just finished Monsters in Love. Different, but some of the same themes there. So welcome. Also a Minneapolis resident and a friend. And I'm really excited to talk with you, Resma, about trauma. What the system doesn't, the legal system doesn't really get about trauma. And I have a framework there, but I want to first say welcome.
Thank you, Sibylle. It's always good to spend some time with you. Thank you for having me.
So back when Derek Chauvin was tried, as we know, there was a teenager and a young girl who were videotaping what happened to George Floyd. The prosecutor during the trial asked for a greater sentence because children were present, which is one of the things in Minnesota law, which allows prosecutors to get a greater sentence. But when the judge wrote his sentencing order, he dismissed that what's called an aggravating factor, saying that he looked at body cam, he looked at video, and he saw, and he called them young women, which was interesting for such young girls, actually, particularly. But also said he saw them giggling and laughing, and he didn't see that as, he didn't see any evidence of trauma, which I ended up writing I was writing a column for the Spokesman Recorder at the time, and I wrote about why that was trauma. But you are the expert. And so I wanted to ask you, what is it that the system, the legal system, gets wrong? What doesn't the system, the people in it, understand? And this particular judge, by the way, was a public defender. He was a prosecutor. He was a long-term judge who just retired recently. So one might assume if anybody had the experience to understand trauma in the system, it would be him. So what are your thoughts on that?
There's so much brutality in that statement. But it comes off as very thoughtful and took time and researched it, but there's so much brutality and feralness in that statement. First piece is the law as it applies to Black people has always been decontextualized. So whenever quote unquote the structure says we're going to mete out justice, or we're going to rectify something, it is always taken out of the context of what has happened and continues to happen to Black bodies. And so the Black body contextually has always had the white body has always had unfettered access to the Black body. For most of our history in this country, the white body has had full and unfettered access to every orifice and idea of the Black body. That's the context. So when a judge makes a statement like that, those are one of the contextual rubrics that I go back to. Of course he would say that, because he is used to having unfettered access as a person who, quote unquote, metes out justice. He's used to having unfettered access to those bodies. What that means is that he believes that his notion, his idea of who and what the black body is his idea of that is more important than what the black body actually is. So the experience of those children's black bodies comes second to the idea. One of the things that D.L. Hughley said in a thing, he said that the most dangerous place for a black body is in the mind of white folks. And so when I look and hear that statement, that's the first place I go to. Of course, he didn't see them as fully fledged human beings, because in this structure, we are not, we the white body is not conditioned to see us as fully fledged human beings that feel pain and experience brutality and experience trauma in those ways, you know. And so his account of what he saw is skewed by his white body supremacy, is skewed by his conditioning. And he will never think that he has anything to do, because he has been ordained by the structure as being the one that gets to determine whether or not something is true or not true. And so that's the first piece.
Can I jump in though? And let's remember
Please.
that was just the first piece. That's consistent with research that we know from medicine, where
That's right. Absolutely.
white doctors believe that black folks don't feel the same amount of pain, which is really, I mean, understanding the context, you can understand it, but kind of shocking too. That I mean, there's all kinds of research about people perceiving black boys as being older than they are, black girls as being older, which is one of the reasons why I mentioned the age, that they were referred to as young women. But also that people perceive black boys as being more aggressive, older, feeling less pain. So there's research out there about people's perceptions of black bodies.
I always start with what I call HIP, right? HIPP. Historical, intergenerational, persistent institutional and personal traumas, right? So there's so much that has been untended to in the structure, legal structure, economic structure, educational structure, so much trauma that has been untended to that has a spring load. Like if you take a rubber band and you pull it, that's always there, right? This is why a lot of times when people like do this DEI stuff and stuff like that, stuff blows up. The reason why stuff blows up is because you're not accounting or you're not tending to the spring load. So tending means that I give voice and room to the fact that what is present in the room is just not our physical selves. That what's present in the room is our history, is our intergenerational stuff that hasn't been tended to, that gets passed down, the persistent violence and persistent institutional stuff, and then our own personal pieces. And so for me, it's really important that when I say to people, particularly community people, that the system is not configured to tend to you. Their understanding of justice is a very feral middle ages type of understanding of justice, right? It is more of a what I call a hacking justice. It is not about, okay, I realize that you just did something to somebody, or you just lost somebody. And that loss has to be tended to over and over and over and over and over and over again. And it may unwind, the personal loss may unwind some of the historical stuff. The historical stuff may unwind and cork and uncork some of the intergenerational stuff. And tending means that you give space communally with other bodies to hold that over time. That this structure is not configured to do that. This structure is configured to put people in jail or execute people or have them pay some penance, but it is not a redress for the harm that has been caused. And they will, and you, me and you've talked about that. People who are honest will tell you that this is not redress, right? This is a particularly draconian way of addressing something that happened, but it certainly isn't addressing the traumatic results of that thing that happened. So, and anybody that says that this structure is about healing, is, you know, or we can bring healing into this structure. I think what you can do is you can create some room so people are not as damaged as they would be, but you are not healing anybody, because healing would involve that you are working with people outside of that structure, and that they are, and the people outside of that structure are tending to the carnage that has taken place, not just looking at it as what we can do inside the structure. If there is nothing in the community and nothing being developed and nothing being worked with, and I'm not talking about what's the thing that people use now? It's
You're talking about restorative practices?
Restorative justice. I'm not talking about restorative practices, right? Mm-hmm. I'm talking about this thing has a 500-year-old spring load to it. We have to help people begin to develop something to address and redress that spring load. And if we're not doing that, we can create things that are fine, but this is not, it's not.
You know, one thing that I've watched, probation officers, judges, prosecutors. I've heard people say he doesn't express remorse, or he's angry, or, you know, just looking at somebody in court and making an assessment of how they actually feel about something, which in my mind is often based, you know, once again, as the judge said, you know, what we're talking about in the beginning, not really understanding what they're looking at. Can
Exactly.
You talk a little bit about that?
Well, you hit on it, Mary. It's the same thing. I can look at a body and determine whether or not it's older or not, whether or not it is remorseful or not. And that's based, what I say it's based on is very unbiased, very clear, very the set of parameters. That's what I say. But what I know is based on is the way that I have been cultivated, the way I've been raised, the way that I understand the world, or the way that I think the world, how the world should be. You know, Malcolm said the most segregated place on the planet is the church on Sunday, right? That white people have been conditioned differently in this structure compared to visibly melanated bodies. And so when people make these snap, I'm a therapist, right? I've been a therapist for close to 30 years. Can't make a snap judgment. I can't look at somebody and say, well, they're really, or they're not really remorseful. Or that's not how it's done. And I think for people to do that, this is why a lot of times Black invisibly melanated bodies don't trust the structure, because they know that the structure is filled with white people who haven't tended to anything, or filled with Black people who haven't tended to, or filled with Indigenous, you know what I mean? It's filled with people. And so I really believe that, I don't think what we need is going to be developed inside of the current structures. I think what we need is going to have to be developed with our genius, with communal scholarship, outside of the current structures, without permission, in fugitive ways. And I think that what some of the people in the structure can do, and what some of the people who have money can do, is that they can give people who are trying to do this, they can say, here's money, here's resources to do it, and go to it.
I've heard you talk about culture, like individual trauma and an individual trauma in a culture. Can you explain that to people?
So trauma in and of itself, if you don't tend to it over and over and over again, it will become decontextualized, which means that it loses its meaning across time, right? That's why something can happen. Like I was in Afghanistan for 2 years. That's why something can happen. I can be just moving along and walking and doing stuff, and then something can happen, and my body remembers it. And I start, and my body reacts as if I'm still in that situation, right? And then I go, okay. And then what I have to do is I then have to tend to it, which means that I need to give room for it, which means that I need to say something to other people so as I'm moving, they have a context for the way that I'm moving. That, you know what I mean? That's a more of a communal piece to it. And so one of the first things that happens when I'm dealing with this stuff is to contextualize, is to say, this thing actually happened, and my body just remembered it again. And so I need to give room for that remembrance. I need to give context for that remembrance. And so trauma decontextualized in a person, untended to over time, can look like personality. Trauma decontextualized in a family, untended to over time, can look like family traits. Trauma untended to in a people, decontextualized over time, can look like culture. Trauma decontextualized and untended to over time in a culture can look intrinsic, right?
Mm-hmm.
It can look standard. And so whenever I'm working with people and bodies, that piece is always at play, right? These are rubrics, these are moorings that I always am holding on to or floating around me or in me. So when I'm dealing with my own trauma or dealing with other people's trauma, I'm trying to hold enough room for that reality, that what I am seeing may be untended to, decontextualized trauma that has been historically, intergenerationally, persistently, institutionally, or personally passed down without any tending to, without anybody looking at it, without anybody slowing down enough to give room for it to breathe so something else can emerge. That doesn't happen.
And this is why, and I you talk a lot about this in Monsters and Love, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, something can happen and your body feels it first and your mind mm-hmm. doesn't even know what's going on there.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And
exactly
there's a right. charge there. You talk
That's
about
exactly
that
right.
charge too.
Yeah.
For
me, Monsters in Love was my attempt to talk about how justice can be cultivated in relationship between people so you have more room. Well, this country has no room for justice for Black folks. It has no room for liberation for Black folks. None. It has no room for liberation for indigenous people. It never has. The very foundational economics of this country was predicated on the genocide of indigenous people, was predicated on the forced labor of Black folks. Until you begin to deal with that, all of this other stuff is moving furniture around on the Titanic.
I think about growing up in Minnesota, which I did, and I have interesting ancestry. Some of my people are from Norway, so I've got kind of the Scandinavian thing. Others from Ireland, but certainly in Minnesota, we have the Minnesota nice kind of, it struck me in reading your work, the whole charge thing. We don't really take, or we don't have, I think, as you would say, a container or the capacity to really confront things, to talk about things. You know, I think about Thanksgiving and my family, even though there was plenty of dysfunction, everybody sort of went about their business like nothing was wrong.
Exactly.
And I think about that in terms of the criminal legal system as well. And having difficulty being able to talk about race and talk about how people show up in court that may be because of trauma. What are your thoughts about that?
No, you just said something. So you said we around Thanksgiving, we just went around the stuff as if nothing was wrong, right? Think about, I always think about how if I just take Black and Indigenous people out for a second, just focus, hyper focus on white bodies. White bodies have been subjugated to this country, have been subjugated to, when it comes to race, to closing, putting their hands over their eyes, putting their hands over their ears, and putting their hands over their mouth. Right? That is the acceptable thing to deal with observable carnage and brutality, right? This is the way y'all been trained, right? This is the way y'all been conditioned. The Duluth lynching had thousands of people that showed up to that. Many of those people that showed up were children. Okay? If you've ever smelled, and I have smelled burning flesh, some burning, it is a particular thing, right? So think about this. There were upwards of five, there's been upwards of 5 to 10,000 lynchings in this country. Most of those lynchings were observed by children and observed by people, right? The natural response to that is to turn away. The natural response to that type of horror is to cower. The natural response to that is to have some type of horror response to that, right? What if you're in a culture though, or you're around people to where that response is thwarted? Like, what if the response is, look at this? What if the response is, don't turn away? And if you turn away, you're in some way feeble, or you're not, right? And that has been the conditioning for white bodies. That stuff gets passed down. So what becomes standard is we don't talk about it. What becomes standard is we can't hear about it. What becomes standard is we can't see it. We can't look at it. No matter how many times you tell us to look at it, we can't look at it. That is the standard rubric of whiteness, right? So that's why I always say, you know, we always want to have these conversations and talk about it, but you haven't done anything about the conditioning. The conditioning among white bodies is the reason why they can't talk about it is that there has been no communal room to address and redress the horror that you've seen, that you know, that you experience in your gut. There has been no communal way to hold that. And until you begin to do that, Minnesota Nice is a way to manage your way through it, right? Minnesota, the passive aggressive type. And I always say it's not, we need to stop saying passive. We need to just start saying aggressive, because to Black bodies, the niceness is not passive. It is active and aggressive. When that judge says that these Black babies, when the judge says these Black babies did not experience trauma, that is not passive, that is aggressive.
So I know you have a time limit here, as do I. Is there anything else you want to say in wrapping up the episode?
Just thank you. Just thank you. Just thank you for giving me the room and giving us the room to begin to play with this stuff. And thank you for what you're trying to do.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So this has been a great conversation, Resma. I'm excited for people to hear the rest of the episode, where we talk about some specific instances that I've experienced as a prosecutor here.
That's
so,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am too. I am too. I think people are going to be really, I think they're going to be pushed a little bit on this, on what they're going to hear, but I think it's important.
Thank you. So the system has been telling everyone forever that the measure of a loved one's injury or life is the punishment. And so one thing that I've seen is that people who are harmed, who come into the system, have been told, I think, by prosecutors and victim witnesses, and I think it's because it's the only tool they've had. Mm-hmm. People come into this profession, they want to help, mm-hmm. they see a grieving person, mm-hmm. and they have tended to say, we're going to get you justice.
Exactly right.
And what justice looks like is some big, long prison term.
Right.
And without really giving the person an opportunity to talk about what they actually need or even realize what they actually need, right. and that might not be it.
Right.
And so they never get what they need. They get stuck.
That's right.
And I think we see that too when people have been, and when we're doing clemency work, mm-hmm. work where we're looking back on a case many mm-hmm. decades, when the family is still as angry
Absolutely.
As they were at mm-hmm. the beginning, mm-hmm. it says to me, we didn't offer them anything.
That's right, that's right, that's right, that's right. The structure's understanding of justice is punishment. Right, but that's the way it was. That's the way the whole thing was constructed. Right, so when something egregious happens, the system's response is not tending. Mm-hmm. It is not tending. It is somebody took something from you, so we're going to make sure that they're punished for that thing that they took from you. Right. But what if our idea of justice is transactional? What if the current construct of justice is a transactional thing? You do something to me, I take something from you. It's transactional. But what if what you are trying to get at is that whatever happens, these are human beings. Every person, whether I'm prosecuting them or whether I'm sitting with the victims, they are people. And they are people that are born into a structure that has brutalized them, right? What can I offer that the system can't? As a human being, what can I offer? What are the things that, not what are the services, not what, that's fine, that's part of the structure, right? But what is it when I'm sitting with a 15-year-old who has in some way caused harm to somebody accidentally, right? What can I offer to that body that may not necessarily germinate now, it may not spring forth now, it may not, I may not see the results of my tending now. But when that 15-year-old who has never had anybody tend to not only the thing that they're struggling with, but the people that they come from have never had it tended to. So historically, it has never been tended to. Intergenerationally, has never been tended to. Persistently, institutionally, has never been tended to. And it damn well sure hasn't been tended to personally. And now they get married. The person who is supposed to be put them in jail and make them pay and do all that stuff, literally say to them, what do you need? I may not be able to do it, but I want to hear you. It matters to me. What do you see yourself after this part of your life has been done, taken care of, or whatever it is, what do you think you need in the course of that 10 years, in the course of that 5 years, in the course of that 2 years, to help you get your feet underneath you, not as vocation, but as a human being, so you can find your purpose, find the things that you want and need? What can I do? Or what would help in that? And most people would break down crying because that has never been tended to. Nobody gave us gave any care about who they were and what they were going through in the midst of this horrible mistake. That's not a system's response. We keep trying to get that to be a system's response. That is not a system's response. That is a human response. It is a human response to ask somebody who has either done something horrible or has had something horrible to you done to them. Not just to ask, but to create the conditions so whatever needs to happen in that moment can happen. Whether it's the grieving, whether it's the wailing, which is different than grieving, whether it's the you actually see that this is something that I'm overwhelmed by, and you are addressing that in the moment. The system can't do that.
I think.
Did that make sense?
It did, and okay. I think so. I've had probably some of the most moving experiences in my term as a prosecutor in the last probably 2 months. Mm-hmm. And that has been sitting with grieving family members. Mm-hmm. And the two I'm thinking about both had boys who were shot and killed accidentally by friends. Kids got together and they were playing with guns, which we're seeing way too much now. And usually, so I always meet with family members if people are unhappy with what the office is offering and they want to meet with me, I will always do that. And these two particular meetings, separate meetings, were so moving to me because people will come in very guarded and very angry, and I sit at the same side of the table in the chair next to me, I turn my chair, and I will look at them, and you know, they'll start talking about how angry they are about what we're doing, and you know, when I listen, and then I might ask them, what do you want us to do? Mm-hmm. What would be helpful to you? Mm-hmm. And they may not know, mm-hmm. or they may think, well, you know, and I think it's been so moving because at times when I can say, and I have said in both these situations, there is nothing that I or this office can do to bring your boy back. Mm-hmm. And for that, I am so sorry. And what I've seen cross their faces is remarkable. Mm-hmm. It is they know that. Mm-hmm. They know that. Mm-hmm. And I think to be told that, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. just to be able to react to that, mm-hmm. because I then see them just break down. And it's been, you know, I'll say to them too, tell me about your boy.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's
and it. They'll tell me wonderful, lovely things about their boy, mm-hmm. and you can see their faces brighten up, mm-hmm. and then at some point they're realizing my child is never coming back.
That's right.
And to just sit with them through that and hear that, and I say, you know, I can't imagine, because I can't.
That's right.
I haven't been in that situation.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
But to try to create that space, and one of the meetings, that case. The mom and grandma came in and they wanted particular things, and through the course of our conversation, the grandma said, you know, it was an accident, I know that, but I just, you know, there's got to be something. And I said, you, from what I'm hearing you say, like, you want your boy remembered. You know, he's not coming back, and I know that. But you want people to remember him. Mm. You don't want people to forget. Mm. And I think what the boy who did this, you know, the way he can honor your son,
is to live a good life and honor the things that, you know, you have told me about your son. And what I saw in them too was a, you know, I want to hate him, but I don't hate him. The sentencing or the resolution of that case happened a couple of days after that, and the grandma rewrote her victim impact statement. And she gave a statement that I heard was incredibly moving. And she talked to the boy who had done this and said, I know you didn't do this on purpose. I want you to make something of your life. And I can only imagine how impactful that was to a boy who's probably overwhelmed with guilt about what he did. And I think what we all too often hear are people who are, you know, told to say, or they're just, you know, that seems to be the reaction that you're supposed to. And some people do have that reaction, like, hate you, you know, that kind of thing, and to be really angry, and you should go away for the rest of your life. Totally understandable. But I tend to think if we can create spaces that are different than that, it will be much more, at least I don't admit, you can obviously talk about, is this the beginning of a healing process? What does this look like for the person who's been harmed?
Yeah, I'm very kind of resistant to talk about like healing, because that, because the, even that idea of healing has been captured, right? They've been, they, you know, it's now become kind of like a tool for the structure, right? This is why I keep using the word tending.
Tending,
right? Is many times we have to be tended to over and over and over and over and over again, especially if we're dealing not just with the personal pieces, but, you know, black people are dealing with 400 and 500 years of spring-loaded racialized harm, right? And it shows up between us, right? Because we know we can't punch up, because they are too powerful. So what we do is we punch across, right? The tending allows for us to begin to work with all of that. Because when my baby dies or somebody kills my baby, I'm dealing with the historical, I'm dealing with the intergenerational, I'm dealing with the persistent institutional, and I'm dealing with the personal. Think about, remember when George Floyd got murdered? Black people, visibly melanated bodies, experienced that all over the planet, right? That wasn't just on 38th in Chicago. Black and visibly melanated bodies knew that story for the last 400, 500, 600. Do you guys understand what I mean? Mm-hmm. So when something is happening, we can't assume that it's only the personal energetics that are being stirred. Sometimes it's the personal and the historical and the intergenerational and all compounded. And so what you do in those moments, Mary, when you say, I'm here, you matter, I wish I could offer you something else, but all I can offer you at this moment is being here and tending to you. That's what I can offer you. And hopefully there are others who tend to you when you leave this office. And then hopefully there's somebody else that's tending to you when you get to your car. And hopefully there's somebody else tending to you when you get home, and after the funeral is done, after all that's done, and you laying in the bed, ain't nobody coming by, ain't nobody checking on you, ain't nobody, you know, nobody's bringing no food, ain't nobody doing. 3 months later, 6 months later, I'm sitting up here. What would it be like to have somebody call you, check on you? I'm just checking on you. Because you matter as another human being. What might happen? What might be more malleable and open to
to tenderness if that happened, if that was part of how we moved. To expect we could train people to do that, you're doing this because it was already in you to do it. Nobody came to you and trained you how to do this. To train you how to tend to. You just, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I know this needs to happen, right? Mm-hmm. And you did it, right? Trying to create a training for the system so people know how to do, that won't work because the people that sit across the table that don't do it like you do it, the people who they're doing it to will have an experience that is being done to them. They will experience it as inauthentic. Because we operate off of vibes, mm-hmm. right? And so I would say to you, Mary, that what you're doing is a way to begin to open the door. But as soon as you leave, the system will have no use for it. That's why you have to do it and write about it and talk to people about it and get people to understand it outside of the structure. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does, and I think about one thing that has been frustrating for me, and it happened very early on. There seems to be a perception. Wait, let me go back to my campaign. I actually talked to a woman who got carjacked. It was horrific, mm-hmm. and I called her, somebody said she would like to talk to me, and she was trying to minimize her trauma because mm-hmm. she was saying, I mean, it was horrible. She was in her underground, her attached garage, mm-hmm. her children were there, and somebody took her purse with her keys in it, knowing where she lived, and she was telling me, and she kept saying, well, but I have the resources, it wasn't that bad, and I kept saying, that was horrible.
Yes.
You don't compare your trauma. Right, yeah. But she said, she was struck by how young they were. Mm-hmm. And she did an interview with News, and she said, I was struck by how young they are, and I'm just not sure I want them to go to prison. Mm-hmm. They're young. Mm-hmm. And she told me that she was vilified. Mm-hmm. She was absolutely vilified because she wasn't the right kind of victim.
That's right.
Can you talk about what is that exactly?
We are conditioned in a brutal, vicious, feral system. It's been that way from the inception. So the type of tending that you did with that grandmother and that mother, imagine that we live in a structure where that never happens. That's the structure we live in. That mm-hmm. not only does it never happen, it isn't even a value. Am I making sense? Like that move isn't a value. So when this person has something happen to them, the only transactional thing is punishment. We've all been conditioned by that. You have to actually have some other conditioning in order to be able to go, I don't want them babies in the jail. I don't want them in prison. Like, I don't know what I don't know what's, I don't, I can't tell you what everything you should, that should do, but I know I don't want that. The system's response is, that's all we got. Like, the system is like, well, if you don't want this, and the people that have ingested the system, if you don't want this, like, what's wrong with you? Like, should I show you again what we got? Like, well, here's what we got. We got brutality and punishment and this and that, and we're going to put them in the prison industrial complex, and we're going to make sure that they work for no money, and we're going to make sure that they can't go to school, and we're going to make sure, like, this is what we got. And you say, that's not what I want. The system has no other play. There's no other play. So of course they attacked her, right? And this is the thing that I think that what this time, the pressure, like the pressure that we're experiencing right now is a global pressure. The pressure that we're experiencing right now, the fires, the presidency, the, you know, Palestine, like all of this type of stuff is all of us are experiencing the squeeze. But it's the squeeze of critical mass. It's the squeeze of generativeness. It is the squeeze that's asking you that once, as you go through this, who are you going to be on the other side? It's not the squeeze of tweaking around the edges. What we know now is that there are no more tweaks around the edges. All of the good stuff, all of the stuff about, you know, we can appeal to people's better selves and all the different type of stuff, off the table. Off the table. Monday proved that all bets are off. Right? That's off the table. So what's being asked of us now, people who believe that there's that there should be other ways, what the squeeze is doing for us is saying, how are we going to be? I believe this squeeze right now is going to create people that stay in their beds or people who didn't even know that they had a liberatory bone in their body and is starting to spark. That's what's happening now. The squeeze is making people go, you know what? I used to think maybe it's this and maybe it's that. Now it's that. That's what it is. And this, I'm good with this. You're starting to hear people who have liberation and understand liberation. You're starting to hear different things in their throat. You're starting to watch them do more fugitive things. You're starting to see that. Yes, it's brutal. Yes, you know, everything that's getting ready to happen, ICE showing up to people's houses. Getting ready to get rid of, usher in a national qualified immunity, right? Like all of that is getting ready, and they think it's going to turn people into powder. That's not what I'm seeing. I'm seeing is making you, people like you, begin to think the system has a particular way it gets down. I want to get down differently, and I don't even know what that is. Let me play. And that's what you're doing. You're starting to play, right? That's how we begin to hand the liberatory nutrients down to our grandchildren's children's children's children. Is by the moves that you're making right now, actually create seeds for people, and room for people to begin to go, you mean I can do that?
Yeah, I wanted to share a story with you and get your thoughts about it. Something I heard about actually recently. So you know that 4th of July, mm-hmm. there are problems with young people and fireworks. Mm-hmm. And people complain, and about 20 young people were arrested this past 4th of July by the police. Got sent for shooting off fireworks at people, you know, stuff like that. And we can debate.
I get you.
So they got sent to our office. They were like 18, 19, 20 year olds with no prior record. Mm-hmm. And our staff and community was trying to be really creative. Mm-hmm. And like, what can we actually do that might help or make a difference instead of, like, we don't want to charge them and get them convicted? Like, how does that help?
That's right.
Right? So they teamed with youth prosecution, and they came up with a really creative approach. It was kind of a 6-month program. They met, they were all Somali kids. Mm-hmm. They met with imams mm-hmm. once a month, and they did a bunch of other mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And 17 of the 20 went through the 6 months, no new contact with police. And then I'm assuming we actually probably dismissed whatever was sent to us. What do you think about an approach like that?
Well, here's what I think. I think, I said to you earlier, playing, mm-hmm. right? I think if you, in the system, if you can create the opportunities for people to play. Well, I don't know about this. Let's try this. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know about that. Let's try that. That, to me, would give more room for more innovative things to burgeon forward later on. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to say this. sometimes when we're creating these things, we're creating these things because something has happened, and so we want to address the thing that happened. Mm-hmm. And what I tell people is that the something that happened when we're talking about black bodies is also historical. Mm-hmm. It's also intergenerational. It's also institutional. To say to them Somali kids, look, we gonna deal with this thing. But we also gonna create opportunities for us to be together and laugh our heads off. Like laugh our heads off and be with each other and chill with each other. We got some place where that's gonna happen. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm doing is I'm not just addressing the fireworks, I'm addressing the people, mm-hmm. and the need to be looked at as I matter, and the need to be looked at as I may have made a mistake, but I am not a mistake. That is a need for those black bodies, even if they had not have been arrested for fireworks, right? So how do we begin to be with each other? Mm-hmm. How do I begin to ask, what you want to do, man? What you like doing? Man, I always wanted to box. Cool. Like, you know what I mean? And I'm not talking mentorship. I'm not talking program. I'm saying people seeing them, laughing with them, talking with them is a human need in a black body, those young black bodies. That's what I'm saying.
So I'm smiling because we invested some money in YGVI, Youth Group Violence Intervention. Mm-hmm. The county holds contracts. We contract with what are called credible messengers. But essentially they are people, and I'm thinking about one of Jamil.
Mm-hmm. Love Jamil.
Yeah, he mm-hmm. works with, and I've seen pictures of these boys. They look like, they are 10, 11, 12. And he takes them out to the Mall of America. Mm-hmm. He takes them out for pizza. Mm-hmm. They laugh. They mm-hmm. do all the things you're talking about.
Glue building.
Yeah. And I heard a story about one of them who said he didn't have school the next day. And he mm-hmm. called Jamil and he said, can I see you tomorrow? Can we hang out? Because I don't have school and I'm worried about what I might do. And it was such a great story. Yes. And to see the pictures of Jamil taking them out and just yes. doing the things that yes. kids want to do and yes. laugh their heads
yeah.
off.
Yeah.
And
yeah. What if these opportunities of our kids or even our adults doing something, what if they were opportunities for tending, not just punishment?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? What if there were really opportunities to tend? I'm tending to you because I know in this structure you've been brutalized, weathered, and withered. I know that. So when this stuff begins to happen and I come face to face with you, I'm going to see you as a human being first. People hear that in a feral system as, oh, that's soft. Well, maybe we do need some softness. Maybe the hardness is part of the problem. Maybe that there's so much hardness that nothing can permeate it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my thing is how do we create opportunities? Even when something's happening, even when they come to your office, how do we create opportunities for tending?
Mm-hmm.
How do we create opportunities to build glue with each other, right? Build glue with each other. The system can't do that. Your willingness to play does that. You know what I'm saying? That's outside. And often what happens is that what I say, all I do, a lot of my writing now is I say, the system is feral and seductive. If it can't beat you to death, it will seduce you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay. So what do we want to bring into the fore that allows us to 10 differently. So that the rubrics, once you leave office, the rubrics are established among how people get down with each other, not how the system can necessarily. There's nothing wrong with trying to get the system to do something. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying do that. This ain't that. And a lot of times we conflate that.
So one of the things it's become clear. I mean, when I was a public defender for many years, I represented many young Black men and got to know them and their history, you know, that kind of thing. And there was so much trauma there. And I always remember thinking, if we had effectively intervened, he wouldn't be sitting next to me.
Well, if we had effectively intervened 500 years ago.
Yes. But so I get in this office and I see some violent crime committed by young people. And I get reports about their history, and it's the same thing
of course.
Every time.
Yes.
It is child protection. It is that kid has never had tending by anyone in their
anyone.
Life. And I think this kid wouldn't be here. But then I think we spent so much time saying, I'm so sorry about what happened to your loved one. When it's very clear, why do we do that? It's never enough. It's never bringing the person back. Why don't we invest where we need to invest so that these things never happen
you
in
know
the first
why.
Place?
You're asking a question.
I know.
You know, Because most of the people in these systems that you interface with are considered fodder. They're considered waste. Right? So the reason why we don't invest is because it's a useless investment. I know that sounds harsh, but that's the way it is. They are not, that's not a good bet. Structurally, I'm not talking about reality. I'm saying it's not a good bet, structurally and philosophically, to put any resources into that. Like I just said, and I was serious about when I said, if we can't in real time right now address the 500 years when that's coming up, and we just address the thing that they just the personal pieces, you're missing what's fueling it.
Do you think, so when I got here, I talked to our staff about, and I had a lot of small group meetings, and I kept saying, you are the most important resource we have. I care about you. And I remember...
How many people left when you...
No, one person raised their hand and said, nobody's ever said that to us before, ever. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that, you know, this job can be... really traumatizing, all the things that people see, but also I think people can in some sense lose their ability to have compassion and see other people's humanity when theirs isn't being seen.
Absolutely.
Too.
This is what when I was working with the Minneapolis Police Department, this is why I had to stop. What you just said. That when I was trying to work with them, when Arredondo was in, when I was working with them, and I would be working with the police officers, and I would be and I wasn't trying to train them. I was trying to get to that stuff, right? The backlash and the foulness for me trying to reach in and say, look, you have to tend to that piece first. This isn't training. This is not training. You have to tend to that because if you don't, your wife ain't messing with you no more. If you don't, your children are gonna think you're a jerk like they do, right? Tend to that piece first, right? So you can become a better human being, right? I did that for a minute and then I was like, you know what? I don't need to do this anymore. The structure would not let me do that, even though some police officers like working with it, the structure wouldn't let it happen. They were undermining, not paying me, doing all, you know what I mean? So when you go in and you say to your team, you are the most important and you matter, that tending has to happen over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. Because the structure says that has no use here and no worth here. And you, just like if I was gonna teach you how to shoot a free throw, right? I'm gonna say you gotta, for the next 4 years, you gotta shoot 503 free throws a day. You shoot 503 free throws a day, you're probably gonna learn nuance. You're probably gonna learn, you know what I mean? There's certain things that you can only learn by the repetition of it. Mm-hmm. This is the same thing. If you're crafting some other type of field, right? The repetition and the reps are required, because what already is has repetition and reps.
That really became clear to me yesterday. We had our first in-person all-staff meeting, and there are about 500 of us, and we ran out of chairs over there in the auditorium. And as I was over there kind of talking to people, supervisors were saying to me, everybody's really worried, everybody's scared. And I said, why? And they were saying, you don't understand the history of trauma in this office. You don't understand. And we mm-hmm. had scheduled this so we could talk about the successes and mm-hmm. celebrate mm-hmm. what the work that people are doing. Mm-hmm. And it was astonishing to me. They all thought I was going to order them back to work full time.
Right.
They all thought
right.
they were just right. apprehensive about right. what was going to right. happen. Right. And I remember at the end I was saying, you know, as we look forward, you know, one of the reasons we brought you here, look around.
That's right.
These are your colleagues. These are the people who can support you.
Yeah.
And I want you to be kind to each other.
That's
I
right.
want
Beautiful.
You to reach out
right.
and say good things
That's
to
right.
people
That's right.
and pick each other up
That's
and
right.
ask people how they're doing. And people walked out of there and you could feel a lightness.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know, somebody said to me, yeah, you don't understand the history of trauma we have. You just thought you were scheduling a happy meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully this will be a change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we need that repetition.
Right. This is something that you are reconditioning. Think about if you were reconditioning some athletes, right?
I used to be an athlete.
Yeah.
I played basketball.
So you know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
If you can't throw the balls out on the court and go for it, there's some repetition that has to happen, mm-hmm. and it's required. So what I would say is, your ability to contextualize, when people say, okay, you don't understand what the trauma is in this office, you now can take that and say, every time you're talking, you're couching that and you're contextualizing. We have had trauma, and what I'm trying to do now is address the trauma by us tending to each other. That's what I'm trying to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And another thing I would say is, the next time you do the meeting, this is one of the, so I'm working with a philanthropic organization out in LA. I'm actually heading there on Sunday. And one of the things that I said to him is, stop having the meetings in corporate places.
Mm-hmm.
Start having 500 people show up to someplace on the north side, someplace on the south side. So then when they come in, don't go right into the stuff. Just stuff like that. We just mm-hmm. gonna sit for a second, y'all. I just want y'all to talk with each other. I want y'all to grab something. Right? You think that's nothing. That stuff is how humans get down.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you do it, the more they start to want it. The more they start to become part of the culture of the organization.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Rezma Menakem. One of the things we talked about was something that our office is participating in, YGVI, or Youth Group Violence Intervention. The idea is that there are young people involved in dangerous activity, sometimes very risky activity like gun violence. And we have contracted with the county to provide what are called credible messengers to work with those young people. As I was talking to Resma, we were talking about how some of those young people are taken to the Mall of America or just hanging out for pizza, where Resma said they can laugh their heads off. So that is one of the ways our office is trying to invest in young people in a trauma-informed way. If you want to learn more about Resma's work, check out his website, resma.com. That also has information about the Black Octopus Society. If you want to learn about somatic abolition, check that out. Join us for our next episode. Thank you.